Could have your attention here. We'd like to kick off activity in the Senate Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee. I just wanted to thank everybody for joining us tonight. I know it's too early to be having evening meetings, but just with deadlines coming up here and busy schedules, we had to fit it in here tonight. Just as a I guess a point for planning, we're looking forward to meeting tonight here and getting an overview from DNR on their agency activity. Also hearing an overview on Senate File 796, which is the agency bill. And moving forward on Thursday night, at the same time, same place, we're planning on hearing individual bills. And then the idea would be to mark up our omnibus bill next Tuesday at the same time here. And hopefully in three committee meetings, three different nights, we're able to pull a bill together and send it up to our full Energy and Environment Committee. So with that said, I guess I think each one of these days we should start off the committee hearing with just a brief story about why we love to be working in this area. Last summer, I spent a lot of time on the campaign, of course, with my car packed full of fishing gear. I live down in the Red Wing area, and lots of nice trout streams down there. And any time I decided to quit door knocking early, I had a trout stream within a short drive. So I was able to get out there and catch some trout and get that fly rod going. So I was very, honored to be able to be part of this committee, and I look forward to working with everybody here tonight. I guess without further ado, I'd like to call Kathy DonCarlos up to give us a little overview of the DNR agency here. And if we have any questions, we can ask as we go through the presentation. Thank you, Kathy.
Great. Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kathy DonCarlos. I work with the DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm Deputy Director. So we really appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you about policy making around fish and wildlife management and also about our division. Feel free to interrupt at any time. We're ready to take your questions however they come up. And you have to pardon me. We put together this overview very quickly over the last 48 hours, and I'm looking at mistakes on my slides. So I'm doing some copy editing in my mind as I'm looking at the slides. I believe that you have a handout of the actual presentation. And then we also brought copies of the fishing regulations, which were just received from the printer today. So these are the 2013 fishing licenses. Fishing regs. Last year's hunting regulations, the 2012 Game and Fish Fund report, and then a brochure that summarizes major activities that are funded out of the Game and Fish Fund. And we'll have a chance to talk about that in a moment. So for this overview, Mr. Chair, I was thinking of just going through the presentation, stopping for questions, and then just opening it up for questions after the overview. Does that seem reasonable?
That sounds great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Fish and wildlife management is a very long tradition in North America. It does differ from fish and wildlife management in Europe. And there are two basic principles that really are recognized by all 50 states and provinces in Canada that are really the basis for fish and wildlife management in North America. And they're very key. The first is that fish and wildlife belong to all citizens. The second is that fish and wildlife are to be managed sustainably. I think we can all remember stories about the 1800s, early 1900s, when there weren't many fish and game regulations, and many populations were brought to the brink of extinction or extirpation. Those days are long gone, and today we use science to manage our resources. And we also recognize that these resources, managing these resources, are a privilege, but also a responsibility on behalf of citizens of each of the states and of the United States government. There are several elements that are important to these core principles. One mirrors the first principle, and that is fish and wildlife are held in public trust. And what that means is that regardless of how much land a person owns, regardless of their background, as long as you're a citizen in good standing, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Let me back up here. Fish and wildlife are held in public trust, which means they belong to all citizens, and they're managed on behalf of all citizens. A second tenet or element is that commerce of fish and wildlife is regulated. And this goes back to what I was referring to back in the 1800s and 1900s when we did not have regulations about commerce. Today we do. Another very important element that you're part of is that angling and hunting laws are created through a very public process. Even our rulemaking is very public. So we don't do it behind closed doors. It's available to be observed and input provided by all citizens. Angling and hunting opportunities are available for all. As long as a citizen's in good standing, regardless of their background, regardless of how long they've been a citizen, regardless of whether they own land or not, those angling and hunting opportunities are available to everyone. This is very important, the next element for North America, and that's anglers and hunters fund conservation. In the case of Minnesota, pretty much 85% or more of Fish and Wildlife Division's budget comes from the Game and Fish Fund, which is funded by angler and hunter licenses and by federal excise taxes. In addition to that, we have many, today in modern times, many nonprofit organizations that raise large sums of money for habitat conservation and species management. Fish and wildlife are also an international resource. We see the benefit of that through our ability to appreciate and enjoy migratory bird species, fish species, a number of species. And finally, and this is really important for our agency, science is the basis for fish and wildlife policy. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk specifically about what we do. But these are the core principles behind our agency and our approach to policymaking. Like I mentioned, this is pretty consistently accepted throughout the U.S. and in Canada. Our authorities for fish and wildlife management come from five primary chapters in state law. Chapter 84, Chapter 86A, which has to do with the outdoor recreation system. The way that touches our division is that we have wildlife management areas and aquatic management areas, and the umbrella oversight for the creation of those systems derived from 86A. And then we have three chapters in 97A, overall game and fish statutes. 97B is devoted to hunting, and 97C is devoted to fishing. Moving on to the Division of Fish and Wildlife, we really have five primary objectives that we keep in mind in all policymaking that we do at our level, all work that we do with you, and all implementation of activities pertaining to populations and habitat. And basically, our objectives are to manage for healthy and productive aquatic and terrestrial fish and wildlife habitat. That allows, having a good habitat base allows us to manage for healthy and productive fish and wildlife populations maintained on a sustainable basis. We're also focused on high quality and abundant opportunities for fishing, hunting, trapping, and other fish and wildlife related recreation opportunities like wildlife watching. And finally, one of our primary objectives is to effectively collaborate with individuals and partners around the state to manage, use, understand, and appreciate fish and wildlife resources. So that's the heart of what we, what's part of our mission and what we strive to achieve in our division. The next series of slides focuses on each of these, and I'm going to separate fisheries work from wildlife work. In some states, fisheries are their own organization unit, separate from wildlife. In Minnesota, the two have been combined. In some states, the Division of Fish and Wildlife would actually be a department. So there's variation across the U.S. on organization structure. DNR over the past, I'd say, 8 or so years has really striven to consolidate organizationally our divisions. And so today, our division encompasses both fish, wildlife, and also licensing. So fisheries population monitoring and management is one of the core objectives that we have. It's focusing on this allows us to base our decisions, our management decisions, and our policy making and policy recommendations based on science, which is a very important thing. And there's two types of science. We'll talk about that in a few slides. But the type of work this involves is surveying for fish populations on lakes, streams, and rivers, monitoring for contaminants. Some of this work is done collaboratively with Pollution Control Agency. We look for many, many efficiencies by working with other state agencies like the PCA and Bowser as well. Our work also involves management of fish populations through regulations on all game fish species in the state. And I think many people understand but don't appreciate the great diversity we have in this state. Given where we are in the continent, we've got three major ecosystem types all converging in the state. And so that results in much habitat diversity and much fish and wildlife diversity in the state. That holds true for fish populations as well. As the chairman mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, he told us about his fly fishing pursuits down in the southeast of the state, which is well known for its cold water spring-fed streams. We have the pleasure of managing for cold water systems, both in streams and in lakes, as well as cool water systems and warm water systems, each with a unique fisheries portfolio of species. We're also involved in propagation for stocking where that's appropriate. Minnesota has many self-sustaining, natural reproducing walleye lakes in this state. Some lakes require just a boost with periodic stocking, and through lake management plans, we identify which of those lakes can benefit by that boost. But I would have to say that the majority of walleyes that are caught in this state are naturally reproducing walleye. We also produce fish for the Fishing in the Neighborhood program, which some of you may know about. It's very popular in the Twin Cities area, but we also have fin ponds in other major urban areas in the state. We're also more heavily involved with disease monitoring and disease testing. And so Fish and Wildlife has a disease testing lab in our division. We also work closely with the U of M diagnostic lab to identify diseases and other pathogens. But that's become a more important activity in recent years, as we all know, with the spread of diseases that weren't here before, VHS and other diseases. And then we also work with the aquaculture industry and the commercial harvesters. So our population monitoring and management work for fisheries is quite diverse, but that allows us to manage fish populations sustainably. On the wildlife side, our population monitoring and management work, in addition, focuses on conflict. As we all know, those species like deer and geese are generalist species, and they're very adaptable and can occupy many different types of habitats. And that's why, in the case of deer, they're found statewide. In the case of geese, we have just unprecedented populations compared to 50 years ago. But with those large populations, there's also occasionally conflicts with the agricultural sector and with individual landowners. And so we find ourselves balancing or managing wildlife populations to meet multiple interests and needs. But minimizing conflict, managing species to minimize conflict is always a very important aspect of our management decisions. The type of population monitoring and management work that wildlife does are annual or periodic surveys, population surveys for deer, grouse, moose, bear, wolf, and many other species. And we do this in many different ways. Sometimes we actually do population surveys. Sometimes we do indices to mark trends. So there are multiple ways of conducting those population surveys. We manage more than 50 wildlife species. Again, I think that reflects this really diverse habitat that we find in the state. As on the wildlife side, on the fishery side, wildlife has found that they're also having to become proficient in managing for wildlife diseases. As you all probably know, chronic wasting disease is a disease that affects deer that has spread to this part of the country. It's now east of the Mississippi. We've been monitoring periodic outbreaks that come from the captive population, captive populations of deer for a number of years. We also recently landed the bovine TB efforts up in the northwest part of the state this year. This year was the first year that this was the fifth year that we have not found bovine TB in the deer population, which indicates that the deer that we had found it in had been exposed to it. They weren't reproducing. Based on the life cycle and the exposure rates, this year we declared that we are bovine TB free in the deer population. But that is the result of very aggressive deer management in cooperation with the growers up in the northwest part of the state. And that response is really unprecedented. Other states like Michigan where bovine TB is now in the deer population have really watched how we responded so quickly and so aggressively to eradicate the disease in the wild population. And they wished that they would have taken those similar approaches when bovine TB was discovered in Michigan. We're also involved in nuisance animal management. We have a program that works with specialty growers that's been around for probably 15 years. It's a cost-share program where we help with fencing to protect specialty crops like apple orchards, vineyards, apiary facilities. We also do internationally based surveys. Our waterfowl breeding ground and habitat surveys are part of a nationwide effort to monitor waterfowl populations continentally. Moving to habitat protection and management, I think when people think about the Division of Fish and Wildlife, the first thing that comes to mind is our work with laws that regulate harvest of fish and game. But really, we wouldn't have these species to manage unless we had healthy habitat. And especially with new opportunities with dedicated funding for habitat work, our work in this area is expanding even more than it has in the past 20 years. This work is important because it helps us manage sustainable resources. But also, the threats to healthy and sustainable habitats are ever growing with the conversion of forests, prairies, and grasslands for other uses. Excuse me. But these conversions that are ongoing even now threaten habitat, abundant fish and wildlife species, and clean water. And so our habitat work is as important as the work we do with population management. On the aquatic side, we've seen very rapid paces of development along shorelines and development in watersheds that affects water quantity and water quality. And really, the legacy funding, helps to address that, but it won't ever take care of it completely. Really, making sure that we have healthy aquatic habitats and healthy watersheds that feed into that depends on a combination of funding and good policymaking, good lawmaking. So what are we doing in this area as far as aquatic habitat protection and management? We have work crews and biologists that specialize in enhancing and managing habitat on cold and warm water streams. We have staff that specialize redesigning dams or removing dams to improve fish populations and movement. We protect through fee title and conservation easements land that we call aquatic management areas, AMAs, that now total almost 900 miles and 44,000 acres of stream, river, and lake shoreline. We also do full lake reclamation projects where we go in and eradicate fish populations that are dominated by rough fish and then restore those populations. We're working very closely with other agencies and with other divisions within the department on watershed-based projects. We're breaking down the silos and working like we do with partners across disciplinary lines to focus on these areas. And then also, as you'll see in our budget bill, actually, which was just heard, on Monday, we also have an aquatic plant management program that works with citizens to manage aquatic plants so that they can recreate and enjoy their basins. On the terrestrial side, we have the same threats. We do slightly different work. We have more than a 50-year-old system of wildlife management areas that today total about 1.3 million acres over 1,400 wildlife management area units, and these are found throughout the state. With that wildlife management area system, we also have to maintain those lands, and we do that through prescribed burns. We do that through water level control. We do that through grazing and haying, and also managing invasive species. Let it be known, we do not haze.
The record will reflect the clarification.
That was good.
We're also involved in designating and managing lakes specifically for waterfall habitat and. This is through the shallow lake designation. We have a shallow lake program, but these lakes are designated for specific management for waterfall benefits. We do a lot of water wetland management through water level controls. In fact, with our wildlife management area system, we have eight or nine major units. One very well-known one is Thief Lake up in the northwest part of the state. And we work cooperatively with the watershed districts in that area to hold water in the springtime, to keep fields from flooding and cities from flooding. And so we work very collaboratively to hold water during key times of the year. We also have special programs for working with private landowners. One that we've been growing the last several years is called Working Lands Initiative, and the goal of that is to create mosaic of prairie wetland habitat on the landscape. But this is a program where we're providing funding to private landowners to manage their land in a way that's compatible with our wildlife management, area management, and other public land management within the landscape. We also do a lot of forest planning through our subsection forest resource management plans. And these are management plans that direct management of forested lands for DNR-administered lands. This is a very complicated process that really takes in the diverse interests that must be kept in mind as we're managing forests for multiple values, not only for their economic value, but also for their ecological values. And finally, and these lists are not comprehensive. This is really just meant to give you a snapshot. We have been working with several agencies, with Bowser, with Pheasants Forever, to provide funding annually to help with sign-ups in soil and water conservation districts for Farm Bill conservation programs. For more information on the specific type of work we do, the Game and Fish Fund report that you have, which is the spiral-bound report, goes into more detail. Our agency is also very much involved in applied research. And when people talk about research or think about research, I think many people think about the ivory tower research, kind of the theoretical research, which is important to our discipline. But the research that we do is very much tied to population and habitat management. And there's really no research that we do that doesn't have a direct practical application. This is very important because the problems and the trends that we're facing are complex and not easily understood. And we're constantly relying on the best science to help us understand what's actually happening. The type of science we are involved with, the type of research we are involved with, is both biological and social. I think we're best known for the biological work. And that includes some examples are some of the research we've been doing on cisco, which is a cold water species. We're very concerned about the trends that we're seeing with climate projections, with development on the landscape, that these cold water lakes that they inhabit are at great risk. And so we're currently doing research to better understand their needs, so that we can more effectively manage their watersheds and their habitat to maximize the opportunities for this species being in the state in years to come. Another project that's probably better known is our Sustaining Lakes in a Changing Environment project. This is a long-term monitoring project for lakes throughout the state. This is benefited by very generous funding from the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund for the last several cycles. But this is a project now that's generating data that's being sought by other agencies, both state and federal. We do other projects like you'd expect to better understand the breeding or complete life cycle needs for species including bass, pike, muskie, walleye. We're also bringing some very innovative cutting-edge research into our inland lakes. Hydroacoustic sampling techniques are currently used in surveying ocean fish and large lake fish, and it's used on the Great Lakes. We now have staff that are applying those techniques for surveying fish on our inland lakes. So there's some very cutting-edge work that's being done on the biological side. On the social side, we are on a regular basis conducting scientifically based social surveys or human dimension surveys of our anglers on their behaviors, their values, so that we can better understand them and develop regulations that reflect what the current needs are. So believe it or not, we don't make this up. Everything is based on information. Very little is soft. On the wildlife side, again, it's very similar. We have programs that conduct research projects on many species, and we seem to be focusing on those species that may be experiencing changing conditions. I think there's been a lot of coverage in the last 8 weeks or so on the research we're doing on moose, which has been a long-term monitoring program. But we're also conducting research projects on other species such as black bears, marten, and even habitat. Our habitat assessments, our habitat research is some of the newer research we're doing, but we're asking very practical questions to make sure that we're managing habitat in the most effective way possible. For instance, we are conducting research right now on how to interseed forbs or non-grass species into prairie plantings. And 20 or 30 years ago, much of the prairie work that we were doing involved just planting grass species. Now we've learned that the more diversity in those plantings, the more species can be supported by those lands. And so we're conducting research now to understand the best ways to effectively interseed those forbs or non-grass species into those stands. Just as with fisheries, we also conduct surveys with hunters to understand their behaviors. Currently, the surveys that we have underway now or recently completed for both fisheries and wildlife include a 5-year statewide angler survey that was completed last year, a bass angler survey that was completed just this year. On the wildlife side, we're currently surveying wolf hunters and trappers that participated in that season to better understand their behaviors and success rates. But these kind of surveys are conducted for many, many different types of hunting and angling activities. Outreach and education is also a big objective for our division. We see that in many other states in the country, angling and hunting rates are going down. Minnesota has a very deep and rich culture of hunting and fishing in the state, and we would like to maintain that as much as possible despite the social trends that we're facing. But the good news is that we seem to be holding our own on those rates. We're one of the top 10 states for hunter numbers, and we're one of the top – I think we're the second or third state for angler numbers, I think following Alaska and perhaps Florida. But we're right up there in the top-ranking states. Our recruitment and retention programs are rather new. They've been around for about 10 years, but they've really grown in popularity. One of the most successful programs that we have is the National Archery in the School program. And after about 8 years of work in this area, we're now reaching more than 2,000 students, and I believe several thousand teachers are certified to be part of this program. Minocqua, which is a longer-standing program and reflects also a national effort in this area to provide aquatic education and angler education, has reached almost 900,000 students through clinics and other activities. So, and recently in this arena, the commissioner has launched a special advisory council to help look at the science behind recruitment into angling and hunting, and to review our programs and look at new collaborative efforts that we can deploy with all of our partners. Licensing is also a big part of what we do, and that's typically the first thing that someone runs into when they're buying a angling or hunting license. We currently have an electronic licensing system that has grown over the last several contracts, and currently we're selling over almost 3 million angling and hunting licenses on an annual basis, and we're titling over 1 million. We're working with over 1 million title and registration transactions each year. We're doing that very efficiently and effectively, both online and in person.
Excuse me, Ms. Dent. Carlos, yes. We have a question from Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of that 2.9 million game and fish licenses, have you broken that into people coming from Wisconsin or Iowa, you know, versus folks within our own state? That's some great numbers. That's a lot. That's good.
Ms. Dunn-Carslos?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have those numbers here, but we can certainly forward them back to you. We do have a large non-resident constituency that come for angling and hunting, and we can provide those numbers for you.
Mr. Chair, I noticed that we lead in the electronic, the leader in license sales and electronic licensing, and it would be interesting just to see, because that's a that should also be a decrease in cost for, you know, actual people-to-people and creating more efficiencies. And can you break that out as well to see how many folks have actually purchased those licenses online as well? As long as you're sending an email, that would be great to add that. So thank you. I won't interrupt again, but that just was like an aha moment. So thanks.
Good question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we'll certainly do that. We have an annual report that summarizes all of the sales by license type, and we can forward that to you.
That'd be helpful. Thank you.
From this data, we do use this data to understand purchasing behaviors and activities, to do surveys, and all of this leads to the generation of license revenue that goes into the Game and Fish Fund for those angling and hunting licenses. I do want to say, and I want to, excuse me for not saying this earlier, but this is our first opportunity to testify before you since last year when the license fee increases were passed, and we do want to thank all of the effort from the Senate last year in helping to pass that, and with our stakeholder groups who really supported that with, I'm sure you could hear that across the state, that there was just resounding support for that. So we really support your work on that.
I wish the subcommittee could take credit, but thank you nonetheless. So,
so in conclusion, all of this work, and this is really just a quick snapshot of what we do. We'd be glad to, if you ever wanted to stop by an office and arrange a day to spend out in the field with us as we're doing surveys of fish on streams, or whether we're at a deer check station checking deer during the hunting season. We'd like to tell you more. But all of this is contributing to those outcomes or objectives that we identified at the beginning of the presentation, and that is to manage for and maintain healthy habitat, healthy populations, high quality and abundant opportunities to fish, hunt, and trap. Especially important is that collaboration to do it together. So I did want to mention, and I think we all know these, our trends and issues that face us are great. And I mentioned to the director before I left yesterday, we had a couple of slides on this, and I just suggested we combine these into one because I didn't want to get too depressed about this. But our challenges are great, but we've got the eye on the ball, and we're watching changing demographics and recreational pursuits. What really has us up at night is those landscape scale trends that we're seeing that have to do with land conversion, how we're using the land, climate changes, invasive species. These are all important. There's not one that's more important than the other. So we have many challenges before us. And with that, I'd like to just open it for any other questions.
Well, thank you, Ms. Don Carlos. I have a question right out of the gates here. If you could just say a little bit more about the land conversion problems that we're facing and if it's specific to a certain part of the state or what, and a little bit more of that story.
Mr. Chair, committee, the land conversion is something that it's been going on for a long time. It can't help but to happen with a growing population and with growing urban centers. But one of the things that we're starting to see more analyses of is conversion of protected land for other uses, and not just for, you know, development for human habitation, but also for agricultural uses in parts of the state that we haven't seen it before. There's work that shows that that's going to be an increasing concern in the north central part of the state. And so that's just one example of land conversion that we're watching at this point. And I think that some of the concerns that come up with that is it's not that, you know, any of this development is bad, but when it happens in a way that's not planned or regulated, it can threaten our groundwater, it can threaten habitat, and these can be very significant changes in parts of the state that have never experienced that type of development before.
Sure. Well, thank you. Well, at this stage, I'd like to open it up for questions from the committee. Are there any questions? If not, I'd like you to just say a couple words about invasive species in Minnesota. If you could just provide the committee just with a brief overview of what we're talking about. It's not just Asian carp. If you could just say a little bit about what's happening within the department on that.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to. That's not my area of expertise, but I can describe what we are concerned about in the division. Invasive species involves both terrestrial invasive species and aquatic invasive species. And I think we've all been hearing a lot the last few sessions about aquatic invasive species and carp. But there's other species of great concern. On the aquatic side, again, I think we're hearing about new discoveries of zebra mussels and other species in inland lakes. And that threat is growing. On the terrestrial side, there are many species that we've been very concerned with for many years. Probably a very common species that many urban dwellers know about is buckthorn. There's two types of buckthorn, European buckthorn and glossy buckthorn. Both were considered good plants to plant back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And in fact, until recently, buckthorn could be purchased, and by recently, I mean within the last probably 10 years ago, up until 10 years ago, it could be purchased as an ornamental plant. But this is these are two examples of species that crowd out native species and take over the understory and really change the dynamics of that system and how that habitat is used. Habitat is has multiple dimensions. I think you can. Everybody is aware of the stories involved in habitat. So you have a canopy in a forested system, and then you have ground plants. You also have mid-canopy plants. Buckthorn is an example of a species that crowds out, shades out the plant species on the floor of the system and overtake the kind of the mid-canopy range. So these are threats that the way we deal with them in Fish and Wildlife is to follow the very strict guidelines that the agency has for managing land and working on land. And, in fact, in every one of our state vehicles, you'll find boot brushes and other implements to clean up our own equipment as we're moving from one site to another. And this is just not for trucks that are located in Fergus Falls or Park Rapids or Duluth. These are vehicles parked in the St. Paul parking lot behind the DNR building. Knowing that, you know, we're often making treks into the field, we're even equipping what would be considered office staff with these kind of tools. So it's very much a part of how we work these days.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Any other questions from the committee here? Yeah, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you were talking about Fish and Wildlife, the Aquatic Habitat Protection and Management slide, you had made a comment about the Legacy Fund helps address this. And then, but it doesn't cover it all. And I guess what's the fear there? What if there wasn't any money? I mean, what's the fix for some of this funding problems that exist in order to keep the habitat protection and management in line? Giving the legacy money is going to be there, but you know you made a comment just saying legacy helps address this, but it's not the end all. I think is what you said. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Ms. Don Carlos?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think everyone recognizes that the legacy amendment provided these four separate funds, and this was just a unique opportunity. We're one of only several states that have dedicated funding at this magnitude for this type of work. So it was groundbreaking to have this passed. But really, we all know that that's not sufficient for the kind of threats that we're faced with. It's being managed in a very prudent way, and so great caution is being used to appropriate those funds for projects. But it's not going to be the remedy for all the threats we face, and We still need to work in combination with really good policymaking to address things like land conversion and land uses and to address how we're using water and how we discharge into water. So it really has to be a combination of policymaking and funding to protect and restore degraded systems.
Well, thank you. I have one final question, and that is just regarding the agency's efforts to work with our neighbors to the north, south, east, and west on conservation or related issues. And I'm just curious what kind of efforts are underway, if any, with neighboring states and such.
Mr. Chair, the Minnesota DNR is actually doing quite a bit to collaborate with our neighboring states. And the upper Midwest region. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is a federal agency, hosts a framework for regional collaboration that they launched several years ago. We're very actively involved in those landscape conservation cooperatives. In fact, there are three landscape conservation cooperatives that intersect in Minnesota. So we're very active, much more than most states. But even before that, we are very engaged in the Midwest Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies and the American Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies on a professional level to remain engaged on federal federal programs and laws like the Farm Bill, as well as other more regional threats and opportunities. One example is some of the diseases I mentioned. They don't occur just starting at Minnesota's borders. Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ontario also experience the same challenges. So we're working both at a national and international level with our partner agencies.
Very good. Well, that's good to hear. Well, unless there are any other questions from the committee, I thank you for your overview of the agency here tonight, and we'll allow you to get a drink of water maybe before we head into an overview of the agency housekeeping bill, Senate File 796. So feel free to take a moment if you'd like, and we can and move on to that. Will Mr. Meyer be joining us tonight, or is he kind of splitting time between here and in the House?
Mr. Chair, I think he's going to come over as soon as he can. The House is hearing fish and wildlife and enforcement budgets.
Sure.
And I know he's going to be over here as soon as he can.
Sounds good. Very good. Please take a seat if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith, DNR Enforcement Assistant Director. And just an update, I had a conversation with Mr. Meyer. He did have to step out. He had a 7 p.m. appointment with his local city council, so he won't be coming back tonight. So.
Well, very good. Well, thank you for the update.
That.
All right, if you'd like to proceed, we have Senate File 796 here, the agency bill here for DNR. And we'd like to just have an overview walk through it tonight. Again, the plans for this bill are to overview this tonight, and then on Thursday evening of this week to hear individual bills, and then hopefully next Tuesday to mark up this bill and pass it out to the broader or the full Energy and Environment Committee. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, and I think that work begins here by getting an overview of the department bill. So with that said, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we're at your service, as I know you're on a very short timeline, so anything you need from us, any information, just let us know. So we're willing to help you with that tight timeline that you have.
Very well. Thank you.
The Game and Fish Bill actually includes provisions that are contributed to by both the Division of Fish and Wildlife and the Division of Enforcement. And so Lieutenant Colonel Smith and I agreed to kind of do an Academy Awards type presentation. We're going to switch back depending on what section it is. So we're going to do handoffs to each other. But I'll go ahead and start. There's 33 sections in this bill. We do have a fact sheet that I'm going to be using as a guide to talk with you. And this provides a very high-level overview that can accompany the actual bill. The first section has to do with game and fish rules. And I just want to back up and say about half of the sections in the bill are technical and half are more content related. And we'll try to identify those as we go along. This is really a technical fix, but in the game and fish rules, we're proposing a clarification language that would allow us in Section 84.027 that would allow us to that would include the explanation of the use of these rules to adjust season variables based on an annual basis based on current biological and harvest data. Rulemaking is done in three different sections of statute. Permanent rulemaking is done in 14.14 to 14.28. Expedited rulemaking is done in 84.027, this section, and emergency rulemaking is done in 97A, Chapter 97A. Expedited rules we've been using for almost 17 years to set seasons, and this is based on using the most current information we have from the previous season. So this is really just a technical change. We've been using the expedited rule section that way, and would just like just propose some clarification in that language. Section 2 has to do with the American Disabilities Act, which requires state agencies to establish policies for the use of power-driven mobility devices on DNR lands. This section would allow us to comply with those ADA regulations using commissioner orders rather than rulemaking. And it would be a very it would be a more effective, expeditious way of bringing us up to speed with those federal laws. Section 3 deals with hunting licenses for critically ill or terminally ill people. We have been doing this at a low level. It doesn't happen very often, but we really don't have the authority to do that. And so this just creates that authority. I think it's just an oversight, and it's something that doesn't happen very often. But we're proposing that the language, that we do have language that allows us to do this. In this particular provision, we would be working with organizations that specialize in doing hunts for critically ill people, and there are organizations that do that. I think that's kind of that section in a nutshell.
Sure.
Yeah, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You noticed the subdivision 20. The bold letters say critically ill persons, yet then you have or have physical disabilities. So my assumption is this is for, like, if somebody was wheelchair bound or their mobility or there was a reason why their disability would be a disabled vet or somebody that's going out, you would make an exclusion to what's going on and allow that person to hunt without doing the lottery. Is that how I understand that?
Ms. Don Carlos?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we already have provisions for working with the physically disabled. The way this sentence is structured, that's referring to a nonprofit organization that works with hunters who are gravely ill or have physical disabilities. So it's that these organizations tend to be multi-purposed.
Okay. I haven't seen the word critically ill used in such, it's like this little people first language is where we're going. And I just kind of thought, interesting. So thank you, Mr. Yeah. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we did struggle with that phrase. And in doing a search on that terminology, critically ill seems to link to refer to people that have terminal diseases, where, death is imminent. We struggled with the exact phrasing to use for that, and that's what we came up with. But there perhaps is some better phrasing that would make more sense.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator Hoffman.
In response to that, thank you. Putting the disability or putting the ailment or characteristic first over the person is kind of an old style of doing it. I would rather see it say persons who are critically ill. Versus two critically ill persons. It's a person who happens to be critically ill. So a friendly voice amendment, Mr. Chair, would be something like that.
All right.
Or maybe that's something to bring up later.
Senator Hoffman, we're not going to mark up the bill tonight, but
okay.
We'll take that into account and
all right. Thank you.
And reflect that in our omnibus.
I appreciate that.
Sure.
All right. All right. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Lieutenant Colonel Smith.
Great. Section 4 is actually somewhat technical. It's just adding a definition to a rice boat. In 86B, where watercraft regulations are, there's really no definition of rice boat, and rice boats during the ricing season do have some exemptions from some registering and whatnot. So we just wanted to have a definition of rice boat. And then sections 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 are really a technical change. And what we're doing is we're changing the terminology from a duck boat to a waterfall boat. And why that's important is because there are early seasons now where a person can hunt geese in open water, and technically they're not a duck, they're a goose. So we wanted to change the terminology from a duck boat to a waterfall boat to make sure that those people can hunt a goose out of a waterfall boat during the early season, if that makes sense. So they're really, it's really a technical issue with whether it's duck boat or waterfall boat.
Very good. Makes us all want to play a game of duck, duck, goose here. But, yes, that's good. That's great. Sorry. So couldn't resist it, folks.
All right. So sections 5 through 9, it looks like a lot of language, but if you see, it's just making that technical correction from a duck boat to a waterfall boat.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
Yes. And then section 10.
Section 10. Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Noncarlos.
Section 10 has to do with recovering costs for escaped non-native animals from game farms, farm servant operations, and ag livestock operations. Currently, we're charged with destroying cervids that are possessed illegally or escaped animals that haven't been recaptured within 24 hours. But there's no funding behind that, and we would like to recover those costs. We have worked with the Board of Animal Health and Department of Ag on this, and they are supportive of it. There is a farm cervid advisory group that we did not apprise of this, and we're in communication with them now to get their support for this. But basically, these are situations where we have to respond rapidly. When we have escaped cervids out on the landscape, there's a potential for spreading disease to the wild population. Escaped swine have always been a problem, and they can, once established and actually feral, they can do a tremendous amount of damage on the landscape. So it's really important that we respond very quickly when we learn of these situations. We're just seeking ability to recover costs for that. Section 11 is really an update.
Excuse me, Ms. Noncarlos. We have a question from council regarding your previous statement here.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Noncarlos, on 5.24, it says the commissioner may collect a civil penalty. Generally, we consider a civil penalty as going through a court process. Is that what's envisioned here?
Ms. Noncarlos?
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry, we don't have the answer to that. Ed Bogus is planning on being here later on, and he may have the answer to that. We thought civil penalty was the way to do it.
It's quite all right. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, generally in statute, when we refer to a civil penalty, means you go through a court process, and we call it an administrative penalty, but something levied by the agency itself. But then we usually like to have some form of process for people to appeal if you're going to be levying penalties administratively. So something to think about. My only concern, Mr. Chair, is if the Judiciary Committee may want to see something like that.
Very good. Well, thank you, Mr. Knopf. If we could just maybe continue this conversation, you could clarify that either tonight or else down the road, and it would be good to know if we need to send this to Judiciary. All right. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for that. We'll follow up on that. Section 11 has to do with the printing of our fishing and hunting regulations, of which you received a copy tonight. The current statute language doesn't recognize trapping. That's just a technical fix. But we also wanted to recognize that we're also providing the regulations online on the Internet. And with smartphones, more and more people are preferring to access the regulations that way. We're trying to keep our costs down for printing these. So between the you know, the new internet tools that we have available to us and the fact that not every licensed purchaser needs a regulation book because they may be a couple or in a family, we're trying to keep our costs down and just make that language more reflective of that. Section 12 has to do with cooperative farming agreements. Currently, statute allows us to use cooperative farming agreements where we work with neighboring growers or people that are willing to travel to the unit to either plant corn or graze or hay. We'd like to expand that from wildlife management areas and scientific and natural areas to also include aquatic management areas. So as our aquatic management area system is growing, we're finding that this would be a good tool to be able to use on those lands as well. So it's somewhat of just a technical fix, including all of our ORA units in this provision.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Lieutenant Colonel Smith.
Section 13 deals with license seizures after a person has illegally taken something that has a restitution value that exceeds $500. And what this, the intent of this is that if they take, for example, a trophy buck, and this is the scenario that played out that helped us come to this language, we had an individual that took a large trophy buck. It was the buck that everybody in town knew, and they took it illegally. The restitution value was over $500. And so we seized that individual's firearms license, and the next day that individual went out and shot another trophy buck with their archery license.
Well, I actually remember this story. I think it was just down the street from me. So
so this is what that language is basically saying, is if you're going to sit on the bench, if your license is going to be seized for taking a deer with firearm, you're also going to be sitting on the bench, or we're going to seize your license for archery or muzzleloader as well. And this would also apply then for small game licenses where the restitution value is over $500. And that is a pretty high threshold. That doesn't happen very often, where somebody in a single course of conduct illegally takes enough small game animals to get that restitution value over $500. In those cases, which are rare, it usually has something to do with trapping. So it would be for big game and small game. So if you illegally took deer, it'd be for all your deer licenses. If you illegally took small game, it'd be for small game. It wouldn't be between the two, though. Does that make sense,
Mr. It does. Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Smith. Do you have a question? Senator Eaton, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered how you determine the value of the animal or the
Lieutenant Colonel?
Mr. Chair and Senator, in Rule 6133, there are restitution values listed for all wild, or for the majority of wild animals in the state. So, and that is done through the commissioner's order. And in fact, we have a restitution value piece here in the bill here at the end for sandhill cranes. So we can talk a little bit more about restitution there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Section 14 is actually a twofer. It has to do with take a kid fishing weekends. Much to our chagrin, we didn't realize that the current language for take a kid ice fishing did not provide for the adult being able to take a fish by spearing without a license on this weekend. So this is a technical correction. The second part of this is setting the dates for both take a kid fishing weekend in the summer and take a kid ice fishing in the winter. This provides for doing it by written order rather than by set dates. We're finding that the dates set for ice fishing are more unreliable as our winters become a little bit more unpredictable. So we would like the ability to set these dates much like we do the special event dates in state parks.
Very well.
That's worked very well. Section 15 to 19 really has to do with providing the same opportunities at the same cost for hunting for non-resident youth as for resident youth. After the dust settled on the license fee increase last year, when we went to implement it, we discovered a couple of things that happened, and these sections address that. The youth resident licenses were reduced from what the agency recommended down to $5, but I think by oversight, we didn't catch that that was not adjusted on the non-resident youth side, and so this provision is just equalizing all of that. When we started to look at it, we realized there were a number of discrepancies between what non-resident youth could do compared to resident youth. So this is just equalizing it for non-resident youth. I can go into more detail on this, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at this, but I can go through it point by point if you want.
I'm satisfied. I think we've had a chance to chat. Members of the committee, would you like some further discussion on this? Yep. Please feel free to proceed, Ms. Don Carlos, moving on from this section.
Okay. Section 20, thank you, Mr. Chairman, has to do with fees for issuing licenses. We have about 1,500 ELS agents across the state, and the statutes provided differences in fees being that they could charge or no ability to charge a fee at all. So what this really does is bring the standard up for that issuing fee to $1, and it specifies that that fee can be charged for prairie chicken licenses, turkey licenses, elk, moose, and wolf licenses. So this really just brings it up and it brings a level playing field for all license types.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, we have a question. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The TLAs, or the three-letter acronyms, are still catching up with me. You just mentioned one, ELS, and I went to English language school, and I'm like, no, that's not it. Can you please?
Ms. Don Carlos?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm sure, sorry. Electronic license system.
Thank you.
I have it. No. So, yeah, our 1,500 agents that sell licenses for us charge issuing fees for these licenses.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Lieutenant Colonel Smith.
Section 21, 22, and 23 all have to do with some changes in the trespass statute, and we'll go through these individually because they are three separate issues within that statute. Section 21 refers to subdivision 3 and remaining on land prohibited after notice. And this came to us through some trial and error with some of our county attorneys, but existing law says that you can't remain on somebody's property once you've been told to leave. And some of the areas we've been having problems, especially with the proliferation of some coyote hunting and people running dogs, are that those people show up later in the day or they show up the next day. And working with county attorneys, if they read the language, existing language as it is written, the landowner would have to go out there every single time and say, get off my property. And what this is basically doing is allowing the landowner to have to tell them one time, get off my property or please leave my property, and they don't have to worry about them coming back over and over again. So this is what that change would do.
Very well.
Section 22 is actually, it looks a little bit more than what it is, but there's a penalty provision in 97A.315 that basically says this part of statute in the existing language is a gross misdemeanor. So if you knowingly trespass on somebody's property or go past the signs, 97A.315 makes you basically charge the person with a gross misdemeanor. And our officers and working with some of our county attorneys, splitting this out by adding the subdivision to or part 2 under subdivision 4, so basically line 1217 to 1218, allows our officers to default to the penalties and game and fish law that would allow them to charge a person with a misdemeanor. So it actually gives our officers the opportunity to charge somebody with a lesser crime than going with a gross misdemeanor for that. So it gives the landowner, the conservation officer, the county attorney, and the violator a little bit of room to work with getting some type of resolution to a criminal case.
Very well.
Section 23 is a change to, I guess, a change that was made last year in the trespass law. And basically, if you indulge me for a little bit, so you have the whole history here. Last year, there was a change that would not allow a person on their own property to discharge a firearm within 500 feet of a stockade or corral. And last year, the legislature defined stockade or corral because we'd never had a definition before. But we found this to be somewhat problematic because it has the possibility of shutting down large amounts of land around the state, both publicly and privately owned, by people that might be in a dispute with their neighbor or don't want people to hunt on public property. And what they could do is, if I could use a visual here, if this is a 40-acre piece of property and you wanted to put a little stockade or corral, so you took a 10-by-10 little fenced-in area and put a goat in there, you wouldn't be able to hunt within 500 feet on the adjoining property. And you could do that all the way around, and we've seen where this has started to happen. And whether it was public property or private property, there's people that are using this change to manipulate, to shut off hunting, not only on private land, but public land. So this change would allow people to still hunt public property, so a wildlife management area, waterfall production area, within 500 feet of that stockade or corral. But it still has that prohibition where on private property, you would need the permission of that landowner if you weren't the principal owner of the property. So if Ms. Don Carlos owned property next to somebody and I wanted to hunt it within that 500 feet, I would have to get permission from the landowner. But since Ms. Don Carlos owned the property, she wouldn't need to get that permission, if that makes sense.
Very well. Good description. Thank you.
Thank you. Section 24 is a technical change to the parent guardian responsibility. We just want to remove the legal guardian. We encourage people to take and mentor kids out in the outdoors. And part of that mentoring responsibility is that you need to be responsible for their actions. And the term legal guardian, I guess, can be was being taken at its face as legal guardian. And, you know, what this bill was, or this language was intended to be, is if you bring somebody out hunting and you're mentoring them, you're their guardian for that day, not the guardian of the state or is appointed by a court. So we wanted to get rid of the term legal and just have guardian, which would refer then to that person that mentored that person on a hunt that day.
Mr. Knuff.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to add, there's a definition of guardian in the Game and Fish laws. So by using the term guardian, you pick up that definition. I don't know if you've looked at that and to see whether that still fits.
Mr. Chair, I believe we looked at that definition, but the word legal is the thing we wanted to get out of the way. And so the term guardian is going to stay there, but what was problematic was the term legal in front of that guardian.
I think the key here is that when you look at the definition of guardian, it means legal guardian of the person under 16 or a person 18 or older who has been authorized by the parent or legal guardian to supervise the person under age 16. So then you do pick up the person. It's not just the legal guardian. It's the legal guardian or the person authorized by the parent or legal guardian.
Nice. Yeah, Lieutenant Colonel?
So, Mr. Chair, he's absolutely correct, but in the statute, is where we're getting under the parent or guardian responsibility. So the definition in Game and Fish law wouldn't change. We just want to remove the term legal in front of guardian, because then guardian will have the definition but we just want to get rid of the word legal in front of it.
And Mr. Chair, that makes a lot of sense, because if you, with the term legal guardian, it would be confusing as to whether it has to be the legal guardian or when the term guardian is used, what if this comes into play. By removing that, you take away that ambiguity.
Okay. Lieutenant Colonel?
Mr. Chair, as usual, Mr. Knopf was much more clear than I could be.
Very good. Well, thank you both.
Going into Section 25. Then, Mr. Chair, Section 25 is actually expanding the opportunity for non-residents to participate in the hunter apprentice validation requirements. So right now, currently, if you're a resident and you don't have the firearm safety, you can come in and use the hunter apprentice program. There's a lot of interest in with grandparents whose kids have moved away and now their grandkids are coming back and they're not residents, so they want to be able to use this. There were some issues with some disabled vets from other states that wanted to come in and participate in some hunts, but they didn't have firearm safety. So this would just basically extend what we think of as a recruitment and retention program to non-residents. So, and then part C, starting on line 1331 to 13, or actually, excuse me, Mr. Chair, 14.3 is basically clarifying that when a person is the apprentice, that they have to have a license. But if it's during the turkey season, they need to have a turkey license during the fall, but it doesn't have to be the A season if they're in the B season with the person, as long as they have a turkey license. And same with the prairie chicken. So it's just a little bit more clarification on that.
Very well.
Then section 26, and if you would indulge me, Mr. Chair, and 29 are kind of together. So if I could
please
add those two together, I'd appreciate it. This was something that was brought to us by a stakeholder group, and we work with them on this language. And this is removing the restrictions related to motor vehicles, and this is specific to bow fishing. When bow fishing came about, it was important at that time that the legislature felt, and I believe probably the DNR, that they were restricted to electric-powered motors. And now what this will do is allow them to use regular gasoline motors. The sport is growing. They're getting into rivers, sometimes with some current. So it just makes sense, even safety-wise, to get them into some gasoline motors. Motors are getting quieter and all that stuff. So this allows people that are participating in that bull fishing sport to use motorized watercraft and not be limited to battery operated. Then section 29, which is coupled with this, is clarifying that we're removing a decibel test. And the decibel test that's being struck in lines 1522 to 1524 is something that really isn't obtainable. And it's a much higher standard for somebody that's bow fishing than somebody that would be pleasure cruising or going out fishing. They have a higher decibel level than the person that is actually bow fishing. And the test that they use that's in here in 1522 to 1524 is something that the DNR has talked with other county sheriffs, and it's not really a usable test. So we're just trying to clean that up as well. So that's basically sections 26 and 29. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you. Ms. San Carlos?
Mr. Chair, moving on with section 27, special hunts. We've recognized over the years that special hunts are just not for youth. We have more and more adults interested in learning how to hunt deer and other species. And so this provision is just removing that reference to youth and expanding it to all people interested in hunting. Sections 28 and 30 have to do with making some rule changes so that use of bait on Lake Superior and the tributaries below the posted boundaries are consistent with invasive species laws. And so basically this is making these changes more quickly than we could do in the standard rulemaking process, which would take 18 months. Basically, trout anglers would like to make spawn bags from eggs they take from trout they hook in Lake Superior and use them elsewhere in the system, and this would allow them to do that. Section 31.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Lieutenant Colonel Smith.
Section 31 is the good cause exemption to for the commissioner to put into rule. And it's 6133 by establishing a wildlife restitution value of $200 for sandhill cranes. There has not been a restitution value for sandhill cranes, and recently, within the last 5 years, we do have a season now in the state, and we would like to be able to put a wildlife restitution value on those sandhill cranes. And just for some background, the reason we have restitution values and why they're important that we have these restitution values are that some of our license revocations and seizures, as we talked about earlier, are based on restitution values. And there's those thresholds of $500, over $500. There's actually a gross over limits, which are over $1,000. But what we did is we looked at the range of the animals. We looked at some research when there was a restitution value offered years back, and we settled on the $200. And if you'd like the file on Sandhill Crane restitution, I can make copies and send it to you.
That's okay for now.
All right.
But thanks for the offer. We appreciate it.
And then, Section 32, Mr. Chair, is basically revisor's instruction and rule to replace duck boat with waterfall boat, as we discussed earlier. And then I believe the repealer removes duplicative language resulting from making the resident, non-resident youth hunting fees consistent with those sections 16 through 20. So.
Very good. Well, thank you both for a great overview here tonight. Very good for us. Just curious, members of the committee, any questions that we weren't able to address tonight? Otherwise, I thank you both again for a good overview and a good start to the subcommittee. Our next step, of course, is Thursday night when we'll hear individual bills. And then again, next Tuesday, we're planning to mark up this bill and turn it into an omnibus for processing into the broader Energy and Environment Committee. So with that said, this committee is adjourned.
Thank you.